Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is your host, Kevin Boileau. At Epis Radio, it is April 5th, 2014. It's Saturday again. I'm pleased to inform everybody that we had an absolutely wonderful Epis seminar this morning by Professor Stephen Goldman on the ancient Greek roots of psychoanalysis, phenomenology, psychology, and modern subjectivity. Absolutely wonderful seminar. If you couldn't make it this time, hopefully you can make it next month when Professor Michel Valentin has his talk and gives a two-hour lecture on some of the problems happening in our culture today and how we can use a Lacanian, a psychoanalytic filter and a theoretical structure to understand how we can get ourselves out of this jam, in other words, cultural transformation. We've been speaking with Dr. Lori Bisbee, a psychologist who is presently stationed in London, the London area. Lori is from the United States, has resided in California, currently residing in London, across the water. And we've been talking about how power operates in relationships. We've been focusing on relationships of partnership, intimate partnerships, boyfriend-girlfriend, spouses, romantic partners, and the like. And we just opened up our discussion last time. I'd like to read a few things before we get back to that discussion. remember that every power relationship implies struggle. And that is when two individuals are in some kind of a dyadic relationship, they can't but help to control the other's behavior to some extent. Now, ideally, we don't do that, and there's lots of books that talk about that. But we all have power. We all are conduits for power. And therefore, we have a way or a nature, a certain energy of sorts that affects other people. And, you know, some of this we're aware of and some of it we're not. It's also true that, and this is really interesting, that at an evolutionary level, there's often a zero-sum game being played, even between people who love each other, even between people who are kind to each other. And by zero-sum game, I mean people try to get their way. I mean, who wouldn't, right? People want what they want. And they hope they can get it from the other person or with the other person in a way that serves the relationship, usually. Sometimes that means, and I think primarily, that it's a zero-sum game. Now, certainly when people talk through their problems and educate themselves and become reflective and mature through life, they can alter that zero-sum game to a non-zero-sum game, which requires a little bit of maturity. One of the things that I want to point out is that talking about power is very complicated. You know, what in the devil is it? Is it a thing? Is it a substance? Is it a something? Is it an energy? Or does the word power, is it a nominalism, or does it denote strategy of sorts, or structure, or strategic interplay? And how can we see power in terms of the various identities that we have? And everybody has a personal identity and a social identity. And I want to just point out a couple things with that. What I mean by identity is that we can be cataloged, categorized bureaucratically, governmentally, through the law, through hospitals and healthcare, through mental health care, through sociology, through educational channels, through geography. There's this really complicated matrix that we can actually come to understand. But I want you to imagine that two people are in a relationship and they each have a different identity. It might be of a different race than the other. They might have a certain traumatic history that's different from the other. But they might talk a little bit differently from the other. So when you start adding up differences, that produce truth. And what I mean by produce truth is we're forced to consider or tangle with what is true and what is false every day. What is right, what is wrong every day. The truth about how to be. The truth about what to do. The truth about who you are. That's our personal identity. And it's my belief, as it was Michel Foucault's, that those personal identities have something to do with the conduction of or conducting power. So we power is something that we produce, or it is something that is actually in the conduits of language that allows us to produce truth or to produce what we consider to be right morally. And I want to go back then to our discussion last week. We were talking about how two people in a relationship can benefit the relationship by actually talking about the various regions of power. And I want to ask, Dr. Bisbee, are you here on the radio show today?
I am indeed.
Oh, you are indeed. And are you presently in the UK, or are you traveling to distant ports?
At the moment, I'm presently in the UK.
Okay, how are you feeling tonight?
I'm good, thanks. What's it like there today?
Oh, did you say it's cold there today?
No, I asked you what it's like there today.
Oh, it's beautiful. The sun is creeping out, and the wind is starting to do a little bit of a dance. So we had really started a great discussion last week, and one of the questions that I wanted to ask relative to what I just mentioned about personal identity, social structures, and what each person brings into a relationship, some people believe that there's an unconscious element to each person's psyche. And if that's true, and I know a lot of people believe that, if that's true, then is it possible that we don't really understand much about power, or is there an aspect of power that we can't apprehend by definition, or is there an aspect of power that we can become aware of if we push into it in the right way, or if we talk about it in the right way? What's your take on that, Dr. Bisbee?
I mean, I think I am one of those people who does believe that we have a degree of ourselves that is by nature unconscious, and that part of what we can do is seek to make more and more conscious. And so if I believe that, then it would follow that I believe that we can seek to make more and more conscious when looking at issues surrounding power and surrounding control in a relationship or even just agency in life, which is to me just another aspect of power. I think this is a really particularly sticky topic because the definition of power and the nature of power can be so terribly elusive, and there are so many different facets that it takes more, I think, concerted attention and structure and perhaps a wider variety of ways of examination to uncover what's actually going on in any given interaction if you're trying to look at the aspects of power within the interaction.
Well, let me bring out one of the criticisms of the attempt to understand power. And this is often a criticism made about mental health care and psychology. And that is, if a couple of people come in and they're in a dyadic relationship, they come to see a therapist, the critique is that depending upon who the couple sees will determine the production of truth. That depending upon the therapist's theoretical background, that what becomes fictionalized as the nature of the truth between these two people doesn't really get them to resolution. it's just another story about what's ailing their relationship. What's your take on that?
Well, as a clinician, I don't wholly agree with that statement. I'd be hard-pressed to wholly agree with it because it would suggest that progress doesn't get made. I do think that depending on the therapist, is the way in which clients learn to frame their problems and their issues, and that certainly the theoretical background, the techniques that the therapist uses, and the therapist's own issues and persona, and if the therapist focuses on the interaction, their authenticity in the session, all of that is going to have an impact on how any client and particularly how a couple will frame their issues and seek resolution to the issues. Ideally, what one hopes is going to happen is that there's a dialogue so that the clients have the space to build their own language and their own concepts, and that both therapist and client learn from each other, and therefore progress to resolution is made.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you have an example that our listeners can benefit from hearing. If we could maybe take a hypothetical case, the typical sort of a situation where power is coming into play in causing a lot of relationship issues. Would you be willing to come up with an example, and maybe we can kind of talk this through in terms of a concrete set of facts?
One of the most common things that gets brought is when one partner is in a relationship, is out working in the world, and the other partner is staying at home and working in the home. There will be issues around finances. There will be issues, they'll bring in issues around freedom. And in some ways, for me, it's more interesting to focus on the issues around freedom and excitement being out in the world in relation to power than it is on the finances, which is sort of the obvious set of issues. The stay-at-home partner will come in complaining that the partner who's out working does not bring enough energy home back into the relationship, that they take the power of the relationship and they take the energy from the relationship outside, uh-huh. and that they take the relationship at home for granted. And you'll begin to see the struggle between the parties, the person at home trying to gain the attention of the person who is out at work, employing strategies in order to try and create a more balanced relationship. And some of the strategies will also cause further problems.
Well, let's see if we can start cataloging regions of or emergences of power. So let's say that the first one might be that the working partner has a certain kind of occupational or professional power.
Mm-hmm.
Let's deconstruct that a little bit. What kind of power is that? Let's talk about it. Let's uncover it. What does that look like?
Well, they have the control and agency in the world. They might be listened to more often. They might gain positive attention and impact on a wider number of people. They gain monetary compensation for what they do, which also gives them another type of power and further sense of being successful and in control.
Yeah, it almost feels like there's an independence there, where they're out in the world
mm-hmm.
Doing productive things. They have a social life. Perhaps
mm-hmm.
they go to the gym or a workout place, midday, halfway through their work. They have colleagues at work they can talk to. They experience
mm-hmm.
successes in their work. and mm-hmm. and that would be bound to, like you say, make a person much more confident. And I'm thinking
And particularly that they feel that they have considerably more freedom. They have freedom to choose. And that's one that gets highlighted a lot, that because they're out in the world, they have freedom to choose.
Well, they certainly
and often,
need... Yeah, go ahead.
Hmm? Well, no, often the person at home will complain that they don't have the freedom to choose.
Right, they're
kind
of
their world
stuck
is more restricted.
Yeah.
Hmm?
That's right, their world is much more restricted. So, I mean, let's talk about this freedom to choose. It's freedom to go shopping to get really nice work clothes. Freedom to pick a restaurant for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom to meet one's coworkers for a drink after work now and again.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole lot of freedom. And
yeah.
So, how about the person at home? Is there a freedom there?
I mean, often people who go out to work say that there is. There's the freedom to take a break when you wish to. There's the freedom to communicate with whomever you wish, not only the coworkers around you. There's sometimes the freedom to have less of a structured schedule, although if the person who's staying at home is doing childcare, that's less true. There's the freedom to choose a wider variety of activities in the day. And the freedom to take a day off, although that will get argued fairly strenuously that that's not the case either, but the freedom to take a day off in a different way, without permission, as it were. Whereas if somebody's going to take a day off from work, they usually need permission to do so. So there are some freedoms. There are some freedoms to pursue perhaps more leisure activities, because there's less of a rigid structure.
So I'm kind of imagining in my mind as you talk, this working spouse comes home wearing really nice professional clothes, made some money, had some work successes, and they're sitting at the dinner table, and perhaps the stay-at-home has made dinner and has not much to report other than, you know, four loads of laundry, you know, a couple of scuffed elbows and knees, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just why is it that there seems to be a stereotype conversation where the person out working, why have we done this where it from everything I've heard in my life that the working person has a greater value than the person staying home doing the laundry and making dinner. There's a power imbalance.
Culturally, that all has to do with money, doesn't it? You know, when you're looking at a barter system, for example, these things equalize much more quickly. Because people are doing things cooperatively and sharing, and they're doing things, although things still have a value in a barter system, it's easier to share things out, and it's easier to see things on a more equal footing, where you see the value in the person who's staying at home, because you have to assign a value to what they do. So you assign a value as though if they're doing laundry, you assign the value as though they were doing laundry in the world. So there's still a perceived value there, and it's highlighted. But when you're looking at people who get actually formally paid versus people who don't, I think it's cultural. How we value the production of money, the receipt of money, much higher than a lot of other things that people are gaining and exchanging as part of their relationships.
So let's take another case. Let's take the case of a couple. They're both professionals. Let's just say a man and a woman, and there's no children. And the woman has had more economic and financial success. She makes more money than her partner.
Mm-hmm.
And from everything I've seen and experienced in clients that I've had, that can be difficult for some partners.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly we're talking about power, and there really is a different kind of a power relationship between those two than if, you know, in traditional ways, the man is out working and the woman is at home taking care of a very beautiful house. It's a very, very different vision or picture or energetic, or it's a very different kind of a power matrix, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, part of it, I think, is not too difficult to understand, in that if you're at home taking care of the beautiful house but you're not earning any income, you are dependent upon the other partner's income in order to maintain the beautiful house. That's just a fact of life, because the beautiful house has to be paid for. Whereas if both partners are working, then they both have much more independence. So the power dynamic immediately is much, much different, because there's less obvious dependence.
And I've heard a number of couples struggle with this sort of thing, where the working spouse or the spouse who makes the greater amount of money really does seem to call the shots. Ultimately, shots about budget, you know, which cars they're going to buy next year, where they're going to go on vacation. Even matters where the greater earning spouse says, you know, defends extra purchases by saying, well, it's my money, I made it.
Yep.
We've probably both heard that a lot.
Oh, yeah, I think that's true unless decisions are made to do it differently. And I think it takes quite a lot of work for a couple to decide to do it differently, because
so
it somehow seems
about,
counterintuitive.
Talk about what differently means. How does a couple take that economic power and bracket it or set it aside alongside all other facets of the relationship? How do they do that?
Well, I've seen it done a variety of different ways. I mean, one way is they make a communal pot for the money. And the communal pot for the money, all financial decisions, big and small, are made together. So basically they have a dialogue on every financial decision. And they try to come to consensus. And I've seen couples do that and be successful to some degree and unsuccessful to others. People forget that sometimes the person who has the higher power job is earning more money and has the greater amount of power also would like to give some of that up, because it's exhausting to be the decision maker all of the time. And that's a pattern that you've pointed out that people fall into very easily. Sometimes the pattern starts because the person who's got the higher financial earnings is the one who takes control. But once the pattern's established, it can become quite exhausting to be the one who's relied upon to make the decisions. So sometimes couples actually decide that who's going to be in control of certain things has absolutely nothing to do with money. So then you're actually consciously handing over control and handing over power. And sometimes they don't make any decisions about it at all and tend to just stick with the obvious and what they've always done, and the person who's earning the most money is the one who gets to call the shots on financial decisions, but perhaps partner will be calling the shots on other decisions in the relationship. And I would argue, actually, if they haven't consciously decided what to do, that's what happens anyway.
What are some of the other areas of the relationship where power is dispersed? I mean, obviously sexuality is one. What's another one?
what you do with the household, the arrangements of the household, leisure time, how things are, the aesthetics of the household. It might be the person with the money is paying for more of the things that are in the household, but the other person might call the shots on decorating. And aesthetics can be a really, really big point of contention. How your environment is organized is extremely important to many people. How leisure time is spent, vacation time, even down to discussion and debate. Who gets more time in the relationship, full stop, can be an issue where there's a huge struggle.
So I'm hearing a lot of issues surrounding time and space.
Mm-hmm. And energy. Those are the three, time, space, and energy.
And money.
Yeah, well, some would argue that money is simply another form of energy.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked too much about sexuality yet. How have you seen that play out in your practice?
In a variety of ways. So sometimes couples come in where that's been a raised issue, but sometimes when there's a real imbalance in power in other parts of the relationship, the partner who has less perceived power in the rest of the relationship may try to exert control in the area of sexuality. And when this is done without agreement and without discussion, what it usually looks like is that's the partner who makes the decision when sex is going to happen and when it's not and what's going to happen. So, for example, say the stay-at-home, because this is what I've seen a lot, the stay-at-home partner who's not happy with the way that the working partner, or the one who's earning the more money, is dealing with financial issues and dealing with issues around the rest of the family resources will become withholding. And so they control sexuality that way because they control what happens and when.
Do you see that on occasion some couples multiply complexity? In other words, it may start with money and then sexuality, and then before long, their whole relationship revolves around responses of power rather than love.
Yes.
So that every area, in other words, every single dimension of the relationship becomes an imbalance of power.
And I think that's much more likely to happen if they aren't actually looking at things and dealing with them and working through them. And one of the things that I note is that people forget relationships actually do take work. And they do. I mean, good relationships take work. They don't necessarily take someone like a clinician to do the work with a person or with a couple. I'm not saying that. But they do take work. You actually have to communicate with each other. You have to be open to each other's ideas. You have to be willing to think outside the box together. You know, those are some of the basics that often people forget about. Because the beginning stages of the relationship, a lot of things seem effortless. And,
well, Dr. Bisbee, we're just about out of time today. We have enough time for you to make a final closing comment today. And then we're going to have to sign off. Is there any final tip or technique that you can give to people in relationships out there?
Examine these things and communicate would be my final comment.
Communicate.
Yeah, that's about it. That's about the size of it.
Well, Dr. Bisbee, thank you very much. All of our listeners I know have enjoyed you in the past, and I know they're enjoying you today. Thank you very much for being on our show.
Thanks. Take care.
This is Kevin Boyle, your host at Epis Radio, wishing you all a very, very wonderful afternoon. Continue to think about power. We're going to talk about violence and power as we push forward into the spring and the summer. To all of our listeners out there, have a really nice day. This is Kevin Boyle signing out.